From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Oops, they did it again.
The disclosure of this program is disgraceful. For a newspaper to publish it does great harm to the United States of America.
President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and most Republicans in Congress are angry at the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal, but mostly the New York Times, for writing a front-page piece offering details of the program by which the government tracks terrorists by following their money. Critics say that the media have put lives at risk because, as Ohio Republican Mike Oxley put it,
"What's the average terrorist to think? He's going to find a different way to move his money around. That's what he's going to do."
What the Times and the other news outlets reported was that the government was tracking the global banking industry about $6 trillion daily through a Belgian cooperative called SWIFT. This despite the urgings of White House officials who claimed that disclosure could jeopardize the program's effectiveness.
On Thursday, the House of Representatives voted along party lines to pass a non-binding resolution expecting, quote, "the cooperation of all news media organizations in protecting the lives of Americans and the capability of the government to identify, disrupt, and capture terrorists by not disclosing classified intelligence programs." Michigan Democrat John Dingell said the resolution was conceived in sin, brought forth without hearings, discussion, or the opportunity to amend.
"The end result? The opinion has to be that this is a clear, bald-faced attempt to strangle criticism of this administration."
And especially, it seems, to strangle the New York Times, the L.A. Times, and the Wall Street Journal, with its staunchly conservative editorial page, have not come in for the same opprobrium. MSNBC's Chris Matthews has his own theory as to why.
"Why is the president going after just the New York Times? It's the old trick. Go after New York. Go after big ethnic New York that never votes Republican. Blame everything on them."
Heather McDonald, a fellow with the conservative Manhattan Institute, says the Times was the first to publish and in so doing pushed the other papers to print. But Los Angeles Times editor Dean Baquet wrote in his editor's notes, much the same as the New York Times editor Bill Keller wrote in his, that the administration didn't make a convincing case for holding the story and that the legitimate public interest outweighed the potential risk. That doesn't persuade McDonald, who declared in the Weekly Standard that, quote, "the New York Times is a national security threat." She joins us now. Heather, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
You went nuts when you saw this story. You're very upset, and you suggested that the Times has, in your words, blown the cover on this terror tracking initiative. Now, the New York Times has also run the National Security Agency story, which seemed to be substantially more cover-blowing. Why were you so aggravated about this episode?
Because I see absolutely no credible argument that this was an illegal program. The National Security Agency program, I think there was a plausible argument that it was a violation of FISA. This, however, was following a duly enacted congressional statute that allows the tracking of international financial transactions. So for the Times to reveal this program, to me, suggests that there's not a single covert program that is safe from revelation. If the Times feels authorized to reveal a lawful, covert action, I see no reason why, if it gets wind of a wiretap on Osama bin Laden's phone, it doesn't reveal that, or if it knows that we have informants placed within Al-Qaeda, that it doesn't reveal that.
Well, this program had been discussed in public, including by the president himself, for literally years before the Times gave us all of the nitty-gritty details. So terrorists who are moving money around the world certainly know that their money movements are being monitored anyway. Exactly what national security harm has taken place here?
The fact that there may be some abstract general awareness that surveillance is a possibility really does not make a difference to criminals in the ordinary course of events. Mafia dons themselves know that their phones may be wiretapped. They talk on the phone all the time. This program, by the Times' own admission, was absolutely critical to picking up Hambali, who was the mastermind of the Bali 2002 resort bombings. It also helped get a Brooklyn man who was involved in a wire transfer for Al-Qaeda that went through a Karachi bank. So the fact is that terrorists are as sloppy as the rest of us and easily overlook the abstract possibility that they may be surveilled.
Well, there is another possibility, that the Times simply overplayed the story.
Well, you had a bipartisan parade of people coming through the Times begging them not to run this story. You have Lee Hamilton of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Keene of the 9/11 Commission, John Murtha, saying that this is in fact something critical to our national security. So again, explain to me why any other covert action is now safe from revelation by the New York Times on the front page.
Point taken, Heather, but you know darn well that the New York Times and many other news organizations often have very sensitive information at their disposal that they do not publish for exactly the reason that you're citing. The question is the New York Times' judgment of overreaching by the government versus the government's reflexive claims of national security. Do you not think that at some point enough skepticism can legitimately build up that would make the a news organization question the government's judgment about what constitutes a genuine breach of national security?
Every case has to be judged on its merits. Cash, the flow of money internationally, is the lifeblood of terrorism. Whether there's a growing skepticism is frankly irrelevant to the case at hand. I've yet to see the Times make any arguments, nor have you, as to what in this program is overreaching. What the Times did say was that there is a possibility of abuse. That is true for every single government program that exists. That possibility that this program could be abused is not, in my view, ground for ending it or for publishing it on the front page of the New York Times, thereby disabling it. But the power of the press can also be abused, as we've seen, in my view, in the New York Times. And we should have checks and balances, which is public opinion.
All right, Heather. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Heather McDonald is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor to City Journal. Scott Armstrong is the founder of the government watchdog group Information Trust. He says that Bill Keller had no need to apologize for running the Swift story, but the paper did probably overplay it.
So the headlines were all wrong. Bank data is sifted by U.S. in secret to block terror. That's the wrong headline. It's not a covert program.
The critics claimed that national security was breached and that the war on terror was compromised by the Times and the L.A. Times and the Wall Street Journal. Does that claim have any merit?
I don't see any merit at all in it. There are two, maybe three basic ways of transferring money, and you have to go through these gating mechanisms. You know, only a fool who had never cashed a check, who was basically paying their bills in gold bullion or something, no one else would think they could escape the scrutiny that this would give. This organization's been around way before 9/11. It has been identified as the principal way of tracking money laundering for drugs, for organized crime, even for the earlier terrorist events prior to 9/11. So the whole notion that it's secret and that this is a big revelation is just absolutely puzzling.
All right. So now that said, the administration and many commentators on the political right and members of Congress went absolutely ballistic, you know, as if troop movements and the invasion plans for D-Day had been revealed in advance. Why are they so upset?
This is unusually shrill. This does not reflect any reasonable measure of damage. I just think people are embarrassed that they didn't realize that they're doing it and may even be doing it well. My suspicion is if the government had stayed with their original tact, which is, hey, this was authorized. It was authorized before 9/11, authorized after 9/11. We're doing it in accord with the law. Congress knows about it. Everybody knows about it. And they just stuck with that. The Times might have run some story about questions about whether or not it's become too broad or it's become more of a database that's being manipulated rather than just subpoenas of information. It would have run on page 823 on a Tuesday somewhere. Nobody would have noticed it.
I was trying to figure out why they gave such prominent display to the story, and it seems to me that it has to do with the pattern of behavior by the administration in its war on terror, and that is, you know, consistent overreaching in Guantanamo with renditions of terror suspects to countries where they are subsequently tortured, to the NSA wiretaps. Do you think that had this been an isolated example that the New York Times or any other news organization would have paid much attention at all?
I think it's in the context that people recognize that the watchdogs aren't watching, because we know that Congress has not been particularly able to inquire into it or particularly interested in inquiring into it. That's the real news in here, is that the government says this is being monitored by an outside auditor. Well, okay, so who is it? Under what strictures? With what standards? You know, they don't have to tell us how to defeat the system, but they have to give the public confidence. And that's the job of journalists. A job of journalists in a nation of laws is to understand the law and understand what's outside the law and understand when the law is getting stretched. And too much of these stories end up being speculative. Some people who don't know much about the program think it might be going too far. They needed to do more reporting and to kind of put us in the perspective of what's important and why it's important. Why is it newsworthy? What should we be watching? Our government can fight a war on terror, but they can do it in a way that doesn't threaten the average citizen.
So if this was a case of newspapers just newspapering, why do you suppose that Times executive editor Bill Keller went to such great lengths to explain, defend, in effect apologize for the story almost simultaneous with its publication?
I think the Times is particularly sensitive about, is this classified? If it were classified, did we do the right thing? People are telling us we shouldn't publish it, but we didn't really think that they were too serious about it. That's a very slippery slope to get on. There does not appear to be classified information in their story. The Times doesn't need to justify itself on those issues. It should be worried about the quality of its journalism. Criticizing the press for this is appropriate if you say they made too much of it. But you should never say that they shouldn't report it. You can question whether that's news, but you shouldn't question about whether it should be suppressed. That would be ludicrous.
Scott Armstrong is founder of the government watchdog group Information Trust.
Coming up, flag desecration through the ages and the positive side of negative political advertising.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 17 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that state laws banning the desecration of the American flag were unconstitutional. So there's been an effort in every Congress since 1990 to change the Constitution. Sure enough, this week, the Senate took up a proposal already approved in the House for a constitutional amendment to permit anti-desecration laws.
The American flag is a monument, a symbol of our freedom, our country, and our way of life. Why in the world would we refuse to protect it against desecration?
Here he is, Kid Rock, with his head through the flag. Is that a desecration? It was such a desecration that he was invited to address the Republican convention, and they partied with him, and they loved him.
That was Texas Republican John Cornyn in support of the amendment and New Jersey Democrat Frank Lautenberg against. In past years, the vote has been largely symbolic, but this time the measure was just one yay shy of carrying the day. It's worth noting, though, that Old Glory wasn't always the political rap of choice. Until the Civil War, it was primarily a military symbol. Ordinary citizens didn't necessarily mist when they saw it and rarely flew it themselves. But that changed almost overnight, says Mark Leibson, author of Flag, an American Biography. The turning point was the fall of Fort Sumter in April of 1861.
It was almost like what happened after September 11th. All of a sudden, where you didn't see flags, flags appeared everywhere in front of people's houses, businesses, stores, schools. Well, you know, women wore them in their hats. Men put them on their wagons and their horses and lapels. And that is the start of what's been called the cult of the flag. You know, during the Civil War, in the Northern newspapers and editorials, the war was portrayed as a fight for the flag. I mean, the song Rally Round the Flag Boys was written during the Civil War. That actual flag that was taken down at Fort Sumter was taken north to rallies, and people, you know, rendered their garments, or, you know, people cried, and it was treated almost as if it were a religious object.
So the Civil War ended and the soldiers went home. The flag had become a kind of religious object. What did it turn into?
Well, it's interesting to note that the first flag protection laws started in the late 1880s and early 1890s, and they were a result of really advances in color printing and mass production. Because once that happened, the image of the American flag was put on every possible commercial product you can name. And sort of the straw that broke the camel's back was when the image of the flag started appearing on beer bottles and whiskey bottles.
There was a flag protection pamphlet in 1902 that denounced the use of a flag in, quote, advertisements of beer, sauerkraut candy, itch ointment, pile remedies, or
right,
as miniature pocket handkerchiefs on which to blow noses.
Yes, right. And, you know, the first flag protection nonprofit groups grew up at that time, and then they lobbied states. And by the turn of the century, by 1900, there were flag protection laws in 48 of the 50 states. They were actually ratcheted up during World War I. For instance, in some states, if you said anything bad about the flag, you can be put in jail. And this was aimed at German immigrants and German Americans who people felt might not be patriotic during the First World War. And there were people prosecuted all over the country and sent to jail for doing things like displaying a German flag or saying something bad about the American flag.
You know, there have been a lot of attempts going back to the 1800s to get the federal government to adopt flag protection legislation. But I guess it took the Vietnam War and the struggles there to get it to spur Congress.
In the Vietnam War, the flag for the first time was used as a symbol, both by those who supported the war and those who protested the war. Those who opposed the war flew the flag upside down. There were flag burnings, and then, as you said, it also led to the first federal flag protection law, which Congress passed in 1968.
People were prosecuted under the law passed in 1968, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And it is really interesting. If you look at a picture of the flag shirt that Abbie Hoffman wore on Capitol Hill in 1968 when he was arrested, which he purchased at Sears, by the way. And then look at the shirt that General Myers, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, wore at the Rolling Thunder Rally in May of 2004. Almost the identical shirt.
Is the issue more about what we do to the flag or why we do it to the flag?
That's a good question. I mean, when you see a car dealer who has the biggest American flag you've ever seen or 50 huge American flags, you know, what is that? Is that a show of patriotism? Is it a advertising gimmick? You know, it's really difficult to sort of put motives on the use of the flag like that.
So it seems to me this is about a lot more than the flag.
Well, obviously it is. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's any coincidence that this proposed constitutional amendment came up now with the 2006 elections coming up. You have to keep in mind this is a very emotional issue on all sides. But it's interesting to keep in mind here that the flag resolution, the flag resolution, June 14th, 1777. You know, we don't know who introduced it. We don't know if there was any debate. We don't know who voted for it or who voted against it. You know why? Because it's just one line in the annals of the Continental Congress. They were doing something else. And then the next line says, the resolve, the flag of the United States shall be 13 stripes, alternate red and white, 13 stars, white in a blue field as in a constellation. And then they went on to something else. They just didn't feel the way we do about the flag back then.
Mark, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mark Leibson is the author of Flag, an American Biography. If, as he suggests, the current flag debate is partly a product of election year politicking, that's nothing new. For instance, Old Glory was mobilized in the 1988 presidential campaign when George Bush Sr. attacked Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis for vetoing a bill mandating the Pledge of Allegiance. Never mind that the state Supreme Court said the measure was unconstitutional, it made Dukakis look bad in those all-important 30-second spots. Attack ads are regularly condemned as a plague on the body politic. But political scientist John Geer argues that negative ads can make a positive contribution to political discourse. He put that argument, along with lots of charts quantifying the content of 44 years of presidential campaign ads, in his new book called In Defense of Negativity. John Geer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start with the most notorious attack ad of all time, probably. It was the Johnson for President campaign ad that suggested that a Goldwater administration would lead to nuclear holocaust. And it depicts a little girl picking petals off a daisy.
8, 9, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
So, fair or unfair? Bad for democracy or not?
Well, this is, you're right. This is an amazingly powerful ad, and at the time it was unheard of to talk about the nuclear issue in such a forceful way. But keep in mind that Barry Goldwater had said prior to his run for the presidency that maybe we should lob a nuclear bomb into the men's room of the Kremlin. He had made these kinds of loose statements. Barry Goldwater made a statement one time that sometimes I think the whole country would be better off if the eastern seaboard was sawed off and it was just allowed to float out to sea. The Johnson people created an ad where actually there was a sawing through a map of the United States where the eastern seaboard then fell off and floated off to the ocean. Barry Goldwater said that. These things weren't made up. From my point of view, it's a very defensible ad as opposed to some, positive ad where Lyndon Johnson is, let's say, sitting on a porch and surrounded by his family and talking about what a wonderful person he is. I don't know what you'd learn from that ad.
So if people praise themselves inordinately, we don't take umbrage. But if they attack their opponent unfairly and with exaggerations, we do. But why wouldn't we? The positive ads, the exaggerations are less corrosive. It doesn't propagate lies about the other candidates or deceptive exaggerations. And it doesn't promote a culture of incivility.
Well, let's think about this for a second. In 1988, Michael Dukakis was attacked very harshly by then Vice President Bush. He also had a positive ad, Michael Dukakis, that is, during the course of the 88 campaign, where he talked about having balanced 10 budgets in a row, touting his physical conservativeness, touting the fact that he was a balancer of budgets. Well, is that true? Turns out the Massachusetts Constitution requires a balanced budget. It had nothing to do with any of his fiscal skills or any of his talents. He had to do it as governor. I could have been governor, and I would have done it. So here's an exaggeration that leads people, if it goes unchecked, to say, hey, this person's fiscal conservative. But in point of fact, they're not. That's pretty corrosive if it goes unchecked.
Fair enough. And you do point out that, in general, critical ads are more informative than the positive ones because they tend to focus on facts rather than hopes and on the candidate's record rather than his or her hopes for the future.
Well, that's right. If you want campaigns to be about issues, if you want those issues to be talked about in specific terms, if you want to have some documentation behind the claims that are being made, and if you want these issues to be things that matter to the public, which are four pretty reasonable goals, negative ads have all of those more so than positive ads. Yeah, sometimes people get turned off by attack politics, but at the same time, an attack may remind you why you are a Democrat. For instance, 2004 was one of the most negative campaigns at the presidential level in recent times. And what happened? The public turned out at a very huge rate. They knew it mattered, and these attacks reflected that.
But things that were aired in 2004, specifically the Swift boat ads, were pretty much made up.
Well, the Swift boat ads are a unique set of ads. They're from these groups, 527s. The 527 ads, both sides had lots of them being aired. The Swift boat ads are the most famous ones, but the problem with the Swift boat ads was not the airing of the ads, was the news media's attention on these ads. They gave them life.
All right. If we want to apportion blame, I'll be happy to reserve a big chunk for the media. But the fact is, what you're saying in your book is that the public ought to embrace negative advertising because it increases our stake in campaigns and it increases our understanding of the candidates. And I say, perhaps, sometimes. But what the public is really furious about is ads that obscure the issues, that propagate lies. I'm not saying that we can ban them. I'm just saying we ought to feel free to hate them.
Well, you can feel free to hate them. First of all, I'm not asking people to embrace negative ads per se. What I'm asking them to do is to accept the fact that politics is rough and tumble, and you need to be prepared for these attacks and defend the kinds of things you've said in the past. Incivility is certainly a problem in American politics today. But if we only allow civil discussion, and let's say there's some issue that's a tremendous outrage to people, and there's certainly some individuals that are totally outraged by Iraq, as an example, why can't they scream about it? Why can't they yell about it? It's one way to create change, because sometimes the public isn't all that attentive and it might take a little bit of yelling. We need this kind of discussion. We need to know the good sides and the bad sides of these contenders, because they're going to hold a huge amount of power.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Vanderbilt University professor John G. Geer is the author of In Defense of Negativity, Attack Ads in Presidential Campaigns.
You're watching a news item on Russian state TV, and heavens to Trotsky, check this out. A demonstration against Chechen separatists, not in Moscow, but in the heart of New York City. Even the American people are taking to the streets in protest. They carry signs, they chant, and luckily, state TV is able to track down the story and dispatch a crew. Well, actually, luck has nothing to do with it. Since 2004, these demonstrations have been staged for those cameras, and the supposed protesters paid in cash to participate. Cash that the Wall Street Journal has traced back to the Kremlin in one of the weirder propaganda campaigns of the post-Cold War era. Alan Cullison is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who co-authored this story, and he joins us from Moscow. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Tell me exactly who these protesters were and how they got there.
There are a combination of people there. A lot of them were inner-city folks who just arrived to get paid maybe $20 or $30 to stand out and get their picture taken. There were quite a few junkies from methadone clinics, but, you know, there were a lot of people who didn't really have much else to do. If you gave them enough money, they'd stand out and basically protest anything. In the summertime, they said that they got quite a few pensioners from Brighton Beach, and then there were some organizers as well. The taxi driver from Massachusetts, who was designated to lead the movement by Moscow, hooked up with a couple of jewelry merchants in New York who were paid quite a bit to get the crowd out there.
Who was behind this?
Well, the organizers in the United States, it was clear that they were Russian immigrants. A couple of people within the movement said that the money and the support and the idea of this traced back to a fellow by the name of Vasily Yakimenko. He's head of a youth group and a political movement here in Russia that's closely supported by the Kremlin. He's been famous within Russia for organizing pro-Kremlin protests, and in the summer and autumn of 2004, the correspondence indicates that he just decided to start doing it in the United States as well.
How much money was behind this scheme?
it was clear that they had spent $200,000 or $300,000 some months. I think they easily topped $1 million, maybe a couple million.
What did Russian TV viewers actually hear along with the pictures of the fake protests?
Well, the state television report was, pretty straightforward. It said that an international movement in the United States has protested today at Ground Zero in New York against the double standards of the United States in the war on terror. And then quoted a couple people saying that, they think that Chechen terrorists really ought to be sent back to Russia because it displeases them that they're living in the United States.
So the Kremlin is upset that the United States is not a better partner in its war against the Chechen separatists and is using this little propaganda device to further its case with the Russians. Historically, state TV has been just a tissue of lies. How do you suppose Russian viewers process all of this?
Russians a lot of the time will talk about how television is full of lies, but actually Russian television is very influential. I think most Russians who see what's on TV tend to believe it. A lot of people close to the Kremlin have been convinced that the United States has been staging protests in the former Soviet Union essentially by paying for them. At least that's the belief of the Russian on the street, really, if you ask them. They are convinced that, for instance, the Orange Revolution in Kiev, everyone who filled the square there and basically overthrew the government in 2004, they were paid by the Americans to be there, and they, at least according to correspondence that we saw, wanted to start up their own movement on American soil.
The G8 summit is headed for Moscow later this year. There were suggestions that there's a connection between your story and G8, as if the Wall Street Journal were somehow enlisted to embarrass the Russian government.
Yeah, that's been a suggestion that the black arts of Western propaganda are going to operate a little bit more heavily before G8, and they'll pull out sort of different stories that will be embarrassing to the Kremlin during the G8 presidency, which is actually an important moment for Putin.
Does nobody look inward at the other explanation that Putin is ever more authoritarian, ever less democratic, and that any reaction from the West to Russia has to do with the government and not with some sort of native predisposition to weaken the Great Bear?
There's an awful lot of suspicion of the West right now that the West will do everything it can to weaken Russia. I think people who are worried about Putin's authoritarian streak here are definitely in the minority. The majority of Russians really like him a lot. I think his popularity ratings are at record highs right now.
Well, Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alan Cullison is the Moscow correspondent for The Wall Street Journal.
Coming up, the suffering book biz considers the big flip.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. My talk with Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank about political slogans like cut and run prompted this from Matt Price of Los Angeles. Quote, In your discussion, I noticed that most of the slogans or shorthand sound bites were from Republicans. Amnesty, cut and run, tax and spend. All of these are obviously negative campaigns. The one Democratic message you mentioned was save Social Security, a clearly positive spin on their message. What about culture of corruption? Democrats have been using that phrase over and over for the past several months. You make it appear as if the Republicans are the only ones doing the attacking.
Elizabeth Nowak writes in to ask, what has happened to your show? Today's show sounds like it was suddenly taken over by the Republican Party. I will never listen to your program again after listening to your story on presidential speechwriter Michael Gerson being, quote, one of the greatest speechwriters of our time. Michael Gerson is one of the worst speechwriters of our time. I cannot believe how you right-wingers can justify your mediocrity. It's shameful.
George K. of Sylvania, Ohio, says I provided a fair tribute to Dan Rather's career, but, quote, you failed to give him the credit he really deserves. Dan Rather, more than any of the liberal network newsreaders, helped spawn the conservative movement in broadcast media. Without his openly left-wing biased reporting, perhaps the right wing could not have come of age with the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. So let's give Dan the credit he deserves, or as Dan might say, that dog can hunt.
Last week, Mike Pesca interviewed outgoing NPR ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin. Listeners wrote in to suggest that Dvorkin seemed a little too sensitive in matters of taste. For instance, he was concerned about Scott Simon's interview with director John Waters and a Morning Edition piece in which someone made a comment about the Easter Bunny and a mother wrote him to say her child cried. Quote, Mr. Dvorkin must live in an ivory tower, writes Terrence McKenna in Dover, New Jersey, or perhaps he never raised kids. When he expressed concerns about the John Waters interview done by Scott Simon, he expressed concerns about, among other things, that kids may be listening. Well, they are not. But if a few of them are, I suspect they understood the body function references better than the cultural references, and I bet they giggled. And Sherman L. Green of New York City gets the last word on this. He writes, what's the difference between an ombudsman and an English nanny? Now that Dvorkin is leaving, perhaps Mary Poppins is available.
Keep those comments and observations coming to On the Media at WNYC.org. And don't forget to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. These are nervous times for the book biz. Bowker, a bibliographic information agency, released a report this month that shows that the industry is printing fewer books for the first time since 1999. Bowker CEO Gary Aiello says he sees that trend continuing, quote, the price of paper has already gone up twice this year, and publishers, especially the small ones, will have to think very carefully about what to publish. Or do they? Maybe the question isn't what to publish, but how to publish. A 50-year study of the book industry produced by a self-publishing house called Lulu suggests that there's a whole new way to build a bestseller. Clive Thompson writes about science and technology for Wired and the New York Times Magazine and blogs at collisiondetection.net. He's here to talk about the book biz and the Lulu study. Clive, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
So can you describe the study that prompted this look at publishing trends?
It was a really interesting study because it was done by Lulu.com, which is a publish-on-demand website. You send in your book and they'll publish it when they get a request for it. And they decided to look at the fate of the bestseller over the last three or four decades. And what they found was very interesting. They saw that back in the 60s, there were very few bestsellers, but they were on the charts for three or four months at a time. And they're big, dominant books. And you fast forward to the 90s and to the 2000s, and it was reverse. There are a lot of books that make it to the bestseller charts, but they're only there for a very short time, a few weeks. The inference was that the sort of age of the big, huge bestseller that dominates national attention span for, you know, an entire season or an entire year is passing into history.
I understand the study said it shrank from a high of 21.7 weeks in the 60s to just 3 weeks in the third millennium.
That's right. Exactly. That's the new attention span of the nation, as it were.
That means more books get to be number one, albeit for a much shorter time. Has the kind of books that reach the top of the bestseller lists changed too?
That's a good question, because if you talk to publishers and if you look at the books that Lulu found that were there, they're more niche focused. I mean, because basically what's happening is they're going after something that is either a short-term trend or it's a niche audience where you've got, you know, 50, 60, 100, 200,000 people who really, really want to read about this, no one else. So they rush out and buy the book, and for 2 or 3 weeks you get huge sales, and then it's gone. Everyone who wants a copy of the book has got one, and it doesn't spread to the rest of society. If you think about what the media sphere looked like back in the 60s, I mean, you have 3 TV networks, you have a very smaller number of publishers, a very smaller number of newspapers, you have no internet. You have no cable. So, of course, it's easier for something to come along and dominate the national attention span because it's so hard even to get into the public attention span at all. So even if the books today are just as big and just as interesting and rich as they were in the 60s, it's just harder to dominate in a cacophony like today's media sphere.
It's actually harder for the publisher to dominate. But as you've argued and as others have argued, it's a lot easier for the people to make those choices. It's very democratic.
That's true. I mean, what you see, if you look at the way things become popular now, it's very influenced by the internet. And on the internet, word of mouth rules. I mean, ranging from someone just emailing something to someone else saying, look at this, to a blogger linking to something else and saying, check this out. And then his or her audience goes there and they link to it and on again, to the fact that once someone's got a whole bunch of links, Google picks up on it and starts returning it as a top result. And then you'll have Amazon, once a book becomes popular, will start saying, well, you know, people have been buying this book. And so it gets a cascade of popularity. And that's very interesting. That's very new.
On your blog, you cite Clay Shirky, the New York University internet theorist, who has written about how the internet has inspired what he calls the big flip. So what's the big flip?
Well, the big flip is that in the old days, and we'll call that the 60s, the way that media worked was that you filtered, then you published, which is to say, if you were a publisher, you sat there and you got your 30,000 manuscripts sent to you and you read over them and you picked the best 10 and you published them. And in the internet, it's exactly the reverse. Anyone throws out their idea on their blog or records their music and puts it online or writes their manifesto and puts it up there. And then the public filters it.
So you translate this into marketing and you come upon this other term that's been around for a couple of years called the long tail. And it has to do with assembling, say, a million audiences of one rather than one audience of a million, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's an idea that came out from Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired. And he was very interested in the shape of popularity because, again, in the old days, in the 60s, to be popular, something had to physically get out to its audience. And so you either made it out to the audience or you died. You know, there's 100 movies produced every year. There's 10 theaters. The 10 that make it into the theaters are seen by the audience. The other 90 vanish, never seen by anyone. You know, same thing with books. Either they make it into the bookstores or they vanish. In an age of digital media and online infinite warehouse bookstores like Amazon, which can keep anything on its infinite bookshelves forever, stuff never needs to vanish. And that means that it can build an audience gradually and slowly or find a very profitable niche. And Chris calls that the long tail, which is that if you were to chart that out, there's a very small number that are really popular. As things get less popular, it's a steep drop to where things are, you know, really not that popular. And then it goes off in the distance. There's just an infinite number of things that are not that popular. In the old days, we would have looked at that long tail and said, there's no money there. We need the hits. That's where the money is in the hits. And Chris is saying, no, in the modern world, there's actually money in that tail. You can put a book out and slowly over years or even decades get an audience.
So can you give me a concrete example of how the long tail works?
Well, one example that Chris Anderson found was the book Touching the Void, which is about a couple of hikers that went up the Andes and had a catastrophic accident. And this came out in the 90s, and it didn't do all that well. A few years later, a book called Into Thin Air came out, and that was about another catastrophic climb, this time of Everest. And it was a bestseller. It went right up the charts, and it stayed there for a while, and then it came down again. But what started happening is that when people went to Amazon and they looked for Into Thin Air, it would say, oh, you know, people who like this book also liked this other book, Touching the Void. And so they started buying that. And it turned out that it got a little galloping popularity such that several years later, Touching the Void had sold many more copies than Into Thin Air. It was actually a bigger seller.
If you were an editor, say, Knopf or Simon & Schuster, how do you use the long tail to make money when you need quick hits to keep the money flowing?
One idea might be, rather than, you know, parsimoniously figuring out a couple of books and sending them out, you get the rights to a whole large number of books, and they're all published on demand. You don't have to have a warehouse full of books sitting there that you've taken a bet on, hoping they move. To a certain extent, maybe it might be more interesting for an author to more easily get their book, quote unquote, signed on for by a major publishing firm and then say, OK, well, I'm going to basically create my audience online, you know, and I'm going to do a better job of that than the publishers do. And I'm going to sell more copies of it. I'm making this up. I don't actually know what the answer is, but I do know that the nature of popularity is changing in a way that is immutable. It's not going to go back.
Thank you so much, Clive.
Take care.
Clive Thompson writes about science and technology for Wired and the New York Times Magazine and blogs at collisiondetection.net.
First-time author John Shores knew he had a problem. It's the problem that confronts all first-time authors, especially novelists. No name recognition, no fan base, and, barring the unlikely intervention of Oprah's book club, no way to cut through the clutter created by all the other first-time novelists. So the 37-year-old scribe has taken a cue from retail politics and is pitching his book one reader at a time, wherever readers gather. Often these days, they gather in living rooms, as KUNC's Nancy Greenlease reports.
Like most book clubs, the 11 women crowded in a Denver duplex realize the importance of food and drink before setting out on a literary adventure. They huddle around a table as Ashley Seymour describes the steaming spread of Indian food.
This is Navratri Korma, my favorite. It is vegetables in a yummy cream sweet sauce. And here's the naan, which is the bread. It's so good. You're going to love that.
The women devour the buffet, selected to reflect the Indian setting of Shore's novel, which centers on real-life 17th-century princess Jahanara, who recounts the building of the Taj Mahal and the civil war that ripped apart her family. At the Denver Roundtable, book clubber Toby McPhail takes on the role of Dorothy Parker as she rips into the passionate princess.
She had that kind of higher calling of not just her parents, but the kingdom.
The duty. You know,
which I kind of got pissed at her for.
I did too.
She was always like, the right thing, which ultimately I was...
Well, one of those things where the right thing isn't the right thing. Stop!
Right. Like, don't overthink it, Jonahara.
Shores takes a sip of his Jack Daniels and Coke and enjoys the show. It's a familiar one for the tousle-haired Iowa native. He's visited more than 170 book clubs from Boulder to Boise, Tallahassee to Tacoma, sometimes in person, most via speakerphone. He's delighted to give readers what he didn't get growing up in a house where his father put a lock on the TV.
And so I grew up reading two or three books a week my whole life. And oftentimes when I was finished reading, I would be kind of musing over the book and thinking that it would really be nice to actually be able to communicate to the author to ask him or her a couple of questions.
His friends could dangle over the dugout and snag autographs from baseball stars, but there was no place to meet his heroes. So he started writing letters to authors.
Larry McMurtry wrote me a really nice letter, and I was really blown away. But unfortunately, he's the only person that ever got back to me.
Shores took a page from McMurtry and responded to his readers. Friends began asking him to appear at their book clubs, and he gladly attended, spending hours dissecting the book. Word spread, and before long, he was calling up to three book clubs a night.
To me, it's a no-brainer.
These chats were cheap, just a nickel a minute, all he could afford since he drained his measly $1,000 publicity budget. But it did stoke sales, and eventually Penguin picked up the paperback rights. Shores put a letter in the Penguin edition encouraging readers to email, and they have. His goal is to speak to 1,000 book clubs in the next year, and the sooner the better, because as any author knows, new books are ditched faster than a harlot in a romance novel.
After about 6 weeks, if a book's not selling extremely well, the publicist, out of necessity, has to move on to other books that are being published.
Craig Burke is a vice president at Penguin and the director of publicity for several book lines. He says the industry recognizes the power of book clubs. Already, nearly every publishing house provides reader's guides. And while it's unlikely that John Updike or Toni Morrison will ever appear in a living room near you, young novelists may soon be lining up out of necessity. New York University marketing professor and former Simon & Schuster VP, Al Lieberman, calculates a new author's chances of success.
Very low. Honestly, very low. About 1% of the books printed each year represents about 80% of the sales. Doesn't leave much room for the others.
It's no wonder that hunky author Sebastian Younger used a sultry back cover photo to reel in readers for his book, The Perfect Storm, while Shores peddles his warmth and accessibility. Lieberman says authors have to sell themselves as much as the book.
And if you kind of come across as reasonably dull, hard to imagine that people are going to be able to overlook that.
Hiding in the shadows once lent authors a certain mystique, but not anymore. J.D. Salinger, a famous literary recluse, once said, "It's all in the book," but even he might struggle to reach a second printing today. Shores, back at the book club, knows that to succeed with readers, it helps to interact with them.
Did the secret passage in the closet actually exist?
That did not exist. There were passageways out of the Red Fort. I couldn't figure out how Johanna and Issa were going to hook up, and I just.
Book club members Ashley Seymour and Toby McPhail say that having the author there really elevated the discussion of the book.
It took us to a new level of like
an actual book club.
Yeah. Beyond just like girlfriends that drink wine and eat yummy appetizers. We became something more tonight.
Mm-hmm. What's the normal book club like without John
sex.
Shores?
Sex.
Bathroom potty talk.
More sex.
Many of the women say they plan to buy copies of Shores' book for family and friends and tell others about his book club appearance. They begged him to return when he finishes his next book, if Oprah doesn't book him first. For On the Media, I'm Nancy Greenlace.
And finally, we invite you to check out the show next week when we celebrate the 40th birthday of the Freedom of Information Act. We'll have some history from Bill Moyers, who was there when LBJ signed it.
The president was not known for his openness. He was not known for wanting to fling wide open the doors of the closet and say, "Come in, guys, and look around, see what you can find."
We'll also have some music and cake. Yeah, maybe not the cake.
In the wake of Watergate and the president's demise, the people knew that time had come to make a change. For the government to have a soul, it's got to live in a fishing bowl under the constant gaze of the people and the Fourth Estate. The legislature heard the people's cry, and it said it would.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Claire Peters and Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.